Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. My friend Peter Shankman is back on Leave Your Mark. And if you missed his first episode, it was in season one, which feels like 400 years ago, Peter. But you know I love seeing you, and you are always a wealth of wisdom and energy. So welcome back on the show.
That's good to be back. I missed you.
I missed you too. For everyone listening, if you do not know Peter Shankman, he is the top keynote speaker in marketing, brand building, social media, and customer service. He's a rock star who knows everything about social media and then some. He's a five-time best-selling author, entrepreneur, corporate in-person and virtual speaker. He focuses on customer service and the new and emerging customer, and also the neuroatypical economy. He has three startup launches and exits under his belt, and he's recognized worldwide for radical new ways of thinking about customer experience, social media, PR, marketing, advertising, and of course, ADHD, which he has. Peter, your career is speaking to people across the entire world. You are a full-time speaker. And we just went through a time where that was not a thing. So catch us up really quickly on how you had to pivot and what you learned.
So on March 12th, I gave my last keynote. It was a Monday morning, 2020, my last keynote in Las Vegas. I flew home and I got off the plane that Monday night. And if I'd known that'd be the last flight to take for a while, I probably would have stayed on the plane a few minutes longer. That Thursday, I got invited to Peloton's grand opening for their new studios. And there was an 8 a.m. class and a 10 a.m. class. I went to the 8 a.m. class. It was amazing. We did this incredible class. Walked out of the class at 9:30 and they canceled the 10 o'clock class. 10th Avenue was empty. The city had shut down. And so I got home, and over the next 48 hours, like 14 keynotes in the following 5 months canceled.
Give us reference point. In a year, how many keynotes do you get booked for normally?
2 to 3 to 4 a month. You know, I'm in Florida one weekend, and then I'm in Tokyo the next Wednesday, and then I'm home on a Friday, and then back in LA the following Monday, whatever. And so, yeah, like over a dozen canceled. And it was hysterical. I mean, it was like, no one knew how long it was going to last. For me, I was just loving the fact that all of a sudden I had like a, you know, I'd book all my flights and everything like that. So all of a sudden I had this like $60,000 credit on my American Express card. You know, it was crazy. And I pivoted to virtual. Everything came back. And virtual for someone like me, someone with ADHD, is nowhere near as much fun. You know, the high I get from the audience, from making them laugh, from the real-time feedback, from a standing ovation in front of 10,000 people, that feeds me. And virtual was fine. It's not as fun, but it worked and I did it and I never slowed down. I gave just as many speeches. The downside for me was that a 45-minute keynote in Tokyo used to take 3 days. I'd leave on a Tuesday. I'd get there Wednesday night. I'd give a keynote Thursday morning. I'd fly out Thursday afternoon. And with the time change, I'd be home Thursday night. I was a zombie, but I didn't miss more than 2 nights with my daughter. Now a 45-minute keynote takes about 45 minutes and it's right yes. from here. Yes. And so it's like, you know, I'll do a keynote at 4 a.m. and like at 5 a.m. I'll get on the bike for an hour and then like, get my daughter to school and at 8 a.m. I'll be back here. Okay, well, I did that. Now what? You know, and like, there's nothing on my schedule. Like, well, I could start another company. I could try meth. You know, it's like, it's, for someone like me, that's not good, right? It's not good to be that empty. So I've started filling my life with lots of other stuff to do. I'm doing a lot. I'm doing some coaching. And it's not that I'm not making money. I'm still speaking. And the speaking is coming back, but they're really going to be back in like 6 or 7 months. I never realized that the pipeline Everyone has a pipeline for where they're going to get their next job or where they're going to get their next business. Most people don't realize where that is. And so my pipeline, turns out, was the 15 minutes after I get off stage. And 20 people come up to me and ask me for my card and give me theirs and say, oh my God, you were awesome. We'd love to bring you into our company and have you speak. That's my next 10 keynotes, right? That completely disappeared. No one's standing in my living room after I click end on my Zoom call saying, hey, here's my card. And so in some weird way, I'm enjoying this freedom that I'm going to have for a few months that I've never had before. This sort of freedom to figure out what else there is there out in the universe that can help me improve on myself. I've started boxing. If you told 15-year-old Peter that he was going to be boxing one day, he would have thought you'd meant like boxing up food to eat. You know, and no,
I can see that though, Peter. I think that you are someone who took a moment of fame, right? For people who have no idea who you are, quickly tell the story of how you put yourself on the map, but more importantly, how you turn that into a speaking career. Because I think a lot of people, especially right now, people are thinking about their personal brands. They want to be considered thought leaders, but it's not as easy as just saying you're a thought leader.
Yeah, I mean, the story is very simple. It's funny. I mean, I want to show you what happens before I tell you the story. I want to show you what happens when you do have ADHD and all of a sudden your life becomes incredibly free. Come here. Come.
No, is that a dog or a cat?
This is the 2-year-old dog that I swore to my daughter up and down. There's no way in hell we are getting. So you knew me. I was a cat guy for like 35 years. All of a sudden I have a rescue dog. Come here, dumbass. And he's not very smart, but he's very cute. We love him. So yeah, my story is funny. I mean, I was in grad school studying fashion and portrait photography and had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I lost my financial aid with 18 credits to go. The government sent me a letter that said, your parents make too much money. We're taking away your financial aid. I sent the government a letter back that said, my parents do make too much money. They keep it. And the government didn't find that funny. And so this is in the mid-90s. I moved back to New York, back home where I grew up in the city. And I was hanging out. If any of your listeners are in the 20s, they're totally not going to understand what I'm talking about. I was hanging out in something called the Melrose Place TV Gossip Chat Room on America Online. And someone in that chat room said, hey, my company's trying to build a newsroom. Why don't you submit your resume? I said, sure. I have no experience. That'll be awesome. Learned that sarcasm doesn't translate online. And I was hired to move down to Virginia and become one of 3 founding editors of the America Online Newsroom. And I helped launch AOL News. And that was the only job I ever had. Because when I left AOL, about 3 years later, they had a mass layoff. I moved back to New York. I'm like, oh, you know, I have all this internet experience. This will be great. I'll get a job really easily. And I did. I got hired by a finance magazine in the city, like immediately as an associate editor. They didn't care how you worked, as long as you get the job done, right? I'm like, this is awesome. I guess all companies are like this. And in fact, all companies are not like that. And so all of a sudden at 8 a.m., we have a morning meeting. And at 8:30 a.m., we have our pitch review. And at 9:30, we have this. And at 10:45, we have this. And I'm like, oh my God, this is Russia. And I quit. I didn't know how to do that. That should have been my first clue that I had ADHD. It wasn't for years. But I had all this internet experience. And you know what? What the hell? I'll try to start a PR firm. All these .coms are starting up and they all need help. Maybe I can do something. I did all this at AOL. And I actually told my parents, I'll never forget this. I said, look, when this fails, not if it fails, when this fails, I'll get a job. It was 24 years last month since I had a real job. I haven't had a good job. So I started this PR firm. I sold it, consulted for several years, and then came across the idea of the thing that sort of changed my life. I talked to everyone. Because of my ADHD, I consider it a gift. If you are in a seat next to me on the airplane, unless you fake your death, I'm going to know everything about you by the time we land. I'm naturally curious. I want to know where are you going? What are you doing? What do you do? Who are you going to see? What's your story? And I love that, right? And I've talked to people on planes for hours and hours and hours. That gave me a really, really big Rolodex. And reporters who knew me would call me and say, hey, I'm doing a story on blah, blah, blah. You got to know someone. You know everyone. Who do you know? And that led to more reporters calling and more reporters calling to the point where I did not have enough free time to find these people. And so I started a mailing list. I started a Facebook group, actually, and said, ah, you know, every time I get a query from the reporter, I'll just send it to them. And that lasted about a week, and we outgrew the Facebook group, and the group just took off, and it became something called Help a Reporter Out, or Harrow. And Harrow is still, to this day, the largest source repository in the world for journalists looking for sources on Deadline. Still a free service. I ran it for 3 years, after which it was acquired by Cision, which is now PR Newswire, part of PR Newswire. It was a game changer for me. I mean, I'd sold my other 2 companies, but this was like real selling company money. You know, this is like, okay, I'm going to buy an apartment now type money. And for me, having just had this idea 3 years earlier, maybe it'll work. You know, it was mind blowing to me, and it still is. And so from that, I tried to spend a lot of time trying to figure out two things: why the company was valued so much, why it sold for what it did, and why I could start and sell a company in 3 years, but couldn't remember to take out the trash or would forget the place that my girlfriend told us to meet for dinner and wouldn't show up. And I discovered two things. I discovered that customer experience and customer service in this world sucks beyond comparison. And I realized I was ADHD. Put those two things together. My last 11 or 12 years since I sold the company have been speaking about both, speaking about customer experience and how to improve that. And I've written several books on that. And I've spoken to companies all over the world about that. And then also over the past 4 or 5 years, back in 2017, I came out with my latest book called Faster Than Normal. That's my first New York Times bestseller. And Faster Than Normal is the premise that ADHD and all sorts of neurodiversity, so ADD, ADHD, executive function disorder, all those things, when managed correctly, when understood what they are for what they are, can actually be an incredible gift. All of my success, the success I've had as a business person, the success I've had as a dad, all that success has come in no small part thanks to my ADHD. And my goal now is I'm speaking to companies around the world explaining why they need to be aware of neurodiverse employees and hire for them and treat them well and give them reasons to stick around as opposed to going to companies that understand them. The reason I didn't survive at the magazine I worked at for a week was because everything was very structured and they didn't allow for anything different. You know, when I was growing up, ADHD didn't exist. When you were growing up, it didn't. It was called sit down, you're disrupting the class disease, right?
Totally.
And
yes.
And I can tell you there's like half a dozen kids at my daughter's school and she's in fourth grade who have already been diagnosed, right? And I'm so thankful that we know that stuff now. But when I was growing up, it was, hey, he's getting in trouble again. He's the class clown. He likes to make the class laugh. He's speaking out of turn. Well, think about it. What happens when you're trying to learn? You need to focus. What do people with ADHD not produce enough of? Dopamine, serotonin, and adrenaline, which are the focus chemicals. What happens when I tell a joke at the teacher's expense or blurt something out in class? The class laughs. What happens when the class laughs? I get a dopamine hit. I was literally getting in trouble because I was trying to learn. And so understanding that now and understanding all these things that I've put into place for my life, including making sure my schedule is booked during these sort of days where I don't have much to do, so I'm not going out and drinking at 2 p.m. or investing in some fly-by-night scheme just to keep me busy. All of that has come from these years of sort of learning about my brain and how it works and the best way to keep me going.
It's so incredible. Peter, talk to us a little bit about how you made speaking a full-time career.
So, I mean, I love being on stage. I love talking. And after I sold Harrow, even during the time that I was running Harrow, I always look for opportunities. I think growing up in New York City has a lot to do with that. You always keep your head on a swivel. I joke now, during COVID, we bought a scooter. So my daughter and I could scoot to her school. I can get her to school without having to take the subway. And it's about a 2.5 mile trip that I can make in 11 minutes, right? We're zooming down 9th Avenue at, I'm going to say 20 miles an hour in case her mom hears this. And we zoom to the school and she loves it. And I was like, oh my God, that's so dangerous. I'm like, no, I am constantly looking 100 feet ahead. That car's going to turn. Is that car going to put in his blinker? It's what we do as New Yorkers, right? It's what I did growing up here. And so I always keep my ears open. And again, talking to people. So for me, when I decided, hey, I can tell stories, that's really what it comes down to. A good speaker isn't about PowerPoint. It's about telling stories. It's about telling stories that are relatable to the audience, whatever audience that is, finding a connection between the stuff you know and the stuff the audience knows, right? You might have stories or you might be teaching the audience something they know nothing about, but if you find a way to connect what they do know to your stuff, every conference I talk about flights and customer experience on planes because everyone has flown to that conference and 99% of them probably had a crappy flight, right? So you talk about things. So I started doing that and I started figuring out what can I do? What opportunities exist out there, whether for speaking or to get myself in the public eye? Well, it turns out that if you are really good at sound bites and you can show that you can come up with cute little sentences that take about 12 seconds and you don't stutter when you're doing them, media will want to bring you on TV and quote you in the newspaper. And so I remember back in 2006, 2007, Nickelodeon tried for a viral stunt for Aqua Teen Hunger Force, the cartoon where they took little, they looked like light brights and they posted them all around major cities, like at the bases of bridges and tunnels and near buildings or whatever. There was a character, I guess, on the show that looked like this, right? And it was this viral PR stunt. Problem was, they also kind of looked like bombs. And they wound up in Boston, I remember shutting the entire city down, right? And the entire city, all the bridges got shut down. It was a mass terrorist attack. Some guy had a heart attack and they couldn't get an ambulance to him. I mean, all this crap. So hearing all this, I had just written my first book called Can We Do That? Outrageous PR Stunts That Work. I remember seeing the story at like 11 p.m. and from 11 p.m. to like 3 a.m. figuring out the email addresses of morning show producers and afternoon show producers and just emailing them, say, hey, I wrote this book. I'm happy to talk about PR stunts and why they work and why they don't work. And it was literally the first time I'd ever pitched myself. And I hit for the cycle, which is CNN, MSNBC, at the time Fox News, and then CBS, ABC, NBC, all in one day. I'm like, wow. And then from that, I got a whole bunch of calls out of the blue. Hey, do you want to talk to us about marketing? Do you want to come to our company? And I'm like, this could be something. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of, you know, and I hate selling myself. I am the worst. My assistant won't let me price myself because I'm like, you know, I'll just fly me out there. My assistant's like, no, idiot. This is your job. You get paid. I can't imagine anyone would ever pay me for this. To this day, I still can't. I have the worst imposter syndrome in the world. But once your name gets out there, it does start to move. And again, once someone hears you, if they like what you had to say, it'll continue to go. And so the key is to constantly be refining it, much like an actor, I guess, constantly be refining what you're doing. But again, know your audience. I have a good friend of mine named Jonathan Murrell. He's in the military, completely different industry from me. So whenever I go to a conference, let's say it's a breakfast conference where you eat first and then the keynote goes on at like 9 a.m., I'll get to the breakfast at like 8 wearing a badge that says Jonathan Murrell. And I've made up a whole backstory for this guy. He works at Arca Logistics. We make international shipping at Breeze. And I'll go with my Jonathan Murrell name tag and I will sit down at a random table at the breakfast and start talking to the people there. Yeah, Jonathan Murrell, Arca Logistics. What are you hoping to get out of this keynote? What, I don't even know what he's talking about. What's he get? And I just let them talk.
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You pretend to be somebody else.
And mind you, Jonathan Murrell is a 6 foot tall black guy. So yeah, it's awesome. But yeah, I pretend to be Jonathan Murrell, who works at Arca Logistics. He doesn't. I made up the company. And I go and I ask people what they're hoping to get out of the conference. And as they tell me, I literally modify my content on the fly.
That is wild, Peter. Do you do that every time?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
But now people like know what you look like.
You'd be surprised. Very, very few people know what I look like. It's, you know, when I'm going and keynoting the National Association of Dental Hygienists or whatever, no one knows that. Right? That's a lot of fun because every once in a while, I'll get my timing wrong. And they'll be like, okay, now our keynote speaker, Peter Shankman. And I'll just, oh. Excuse me. And I'll take off a badge and get on stage.
Oh my God. That is the funniest thing ever.
But again, I think what it comes down to and what your audience wants to get out of this is like, why are we listening to this guy? Everyone does the most minimal amount of whatever, right? It takes less than 1% to win literally all the things. I never get on a plane. And before COVID, in 2019, I traveled 350,000 miles in a year. So a lot of international flights, a lot of whatever. I never get on a plane without a 2-pound family-sized bag of M&Ms. You're like, why? Well, I get on the plane and think about what flying has become. Flying kind of sucks right now, right? It was like, so it always sucked. But, you know, it's no longer the 1950s glamorous that it was. Now it's get on the plane, keep your head down, sit down, shut up, don't cause trouble, get off the plane, you know, and that's about it. So flight attendants, while they love what they do, they have pretty shitty jobs, right? It's like, I give flight attendants a ton of credit, especially post-COVID. People are just assholes. And so I get on the plane. I usually board first because of how much I travel, my status. And so I get on, and I, as I'm walking to my seat, I see a flight attendant. I'm like, excuse me, who's the lead? And they automatically get defensive. Like, who's the lead flight attendant? Who's in charge? And they automatically get defensive. Like, oh, great. What's he, you know, he's a Karen. What does he want? He wants to complain. And so they point her out or him out. And I go up and I'm like, excuse me, you're the lead? And they go, yeah. I'm like, great. These are for you. You just got to share them with your coworkers though. And I just walk to my seat. And then the flight attendant goes through what I call the 5 stages of M&M's disbelief, which is, what does this guy do? What does he want? What is he going to complain about? What is he giving me? Holy shit, it's chocolate. This is the greatest flight ever. And then after that, 240 people behind me board the plane, and every single one of them has just gotten a happiness upgrade because now you have 8 flight attendants over the entire plane. Without fail, the lead before everyone sits on, dude, candy up front. And they'll all run up and they'll all grab a cup of candy and then they'll go back to their stations. And now you have 8, 9, 10 flight attendants who are like, hi, welcome aboard. Hi, hi, everything's awesome. Look, sucker. And it cost me like $11. And I do this every single flight.
I did not know M&Ms were that powerful. I'll be honest.
Oh, you have no idea.
I know they don't melt in your hand, but I didn't know they were that powerful.
Oh, M&Ms will change your life. And it's funny because we are so cynical as society that the majority of people automatically say, that, you know, like the flight attendant's like, oh, thanks so much. Where are you sitting? I'm like, nah, I don't need an upgrade. I'm in 2A. Just enjoy the M&Ms, right? They're like, well, bring a drink. I don't drink. It's really good. Just enjoy the sugar. It doesn't take much to exceed anyone's expectations. My favorite story, I think I introduced you. I had a former girlfriend named Jennifer Hartstein. I think you guys met. She, it's funny, I got her gig as she was the CBS Early Show contributing psychologist. She runs a psychology practice in the city. And we met, I think in like December of 2001 and dated for about 4 years. And she told me to this day, she was not planning on having a second date with me. She did not find me attractive to begin with. And didn't think I was her type. I mean, yeah, she's incredibly forward about that. But what she did say, she said the reason she was willing to give me a second chance was because on our first date, I asked her about her day and I stood up when she went to the bathroom at our dinner. I learned that from Tony Bennett. So somehow my father wound up being an advisor to this school called the Frank Sinatra School for the Arts, helmed by Tony Bennett, when it first opened like 20 years ago. And somehow we all wound up at dinner one night. My father, my mother, me, Tony Bennett, and his very young girlfriend. And we go to Nobu without a reservation because he's Tony and Bennett. And we walk in and we sit down. And over the course of the meal, at some point, my mother got up to go to the bathroom and Tony Bennett stood up. And my mother came back to the bathroom and Tony Bennett stood up. My father and I, you ever watch The Simpsons when they eat? Yeah. My dad and I just ate, you know, complete gorgeous up on sushi. Didn't even know my mother left. And when we left the restaurant, Tony Bennett and his girlfriend went one way. And my dad and my mom and me were looking for a cab. And my dad goes, my God, that food was amazing. I'm like, yeah, that food was incredible, man. Because Tony Bennett stood up for me when I went to the bathroom and didn't talk to either of us for a week. So that right there was my lesson. Right? You don't need to be amazing. I don't need you to be awesome. I don't need businesses to be awesome. I don't need employees. You want me to hire you? I don't need you to be awesome. I need you to be 5 seconds better, half a level better than what we expect, because we don't expect much.
What is the number one rule of thumb for companies today? When you go to speak at a company, because I know you school them, what are you shaming them with? What are you telling them they're doing wrong?
Be brilliant at the basics. I had a journalism professor who once said, be brilliant at the basics. And if you can get through that, everything else is cream cheese. And what do I mean by that? Again, it goes back to the bar being as low as it is. My favorite pitch, and I still get probably 100 pitches a week from reporters all around the world who have no idea what I cover, what I write about, or what I talk about on TV. And they pitch me on everything. And my favorite worst pitch to this day came in May of 2019. Dear Peter. So they got my name right. Dear Peter. We know that working moms like you have it hard.
Okay.
So do the most basic of homework. In New York City, there's a place when your kid is born and they're 6 months old or whatever, they go to socialization classes at this place called Kidville.
Kidville.
You know Kidville, right? So there's one about 20 blocks away from my apartment, and I was married at the time. And so my wife and I, we took her up there, and I was nervous. She'd never been away from me, whatever. Apparently, as far as I can tell, they take the kid, they throw him in a ball pit, and you pick him up 3 hours later. I don't know. But I took her there and was a little nervous, first time away. I go back 3 hours later. She seems to be happy. She seems to have played in the ball pit. She has all her fingers, all her toes. I'm like, okay, great. I'll bring her back the next time. I get home. I put her to sleep. I get an email that night from Kidville thanking me for bringing my daughter there and for letting them take care of her. And the letter said, dear Mr. Shankman, thank you so much for allowing us the privilege of watching Jessica today. Mm. My daughter's name is Jessa, not Jessica. If there's anything that better defines that you had one job, I don't know what it is. Because now I have to go inside, wake up my daughter, and make sure you give me the right damn kid. Right? That's the basics that I'm talking about. And the best part was I told them that, oh my God, you know what? Microsoft, I'm sure that it was an autocorrect. Yeah, look deep in my eyes and see if I care why. The fact of the matter is that you got my daughter's name wrong, right? I don't need you to be awesome, but you got my daughter's name wrong. And if she's 6 months old and I'm leaving her in your care at 6 months, you might want to not get her name wrong. It's the little things like that, being brilliant at the basics. I teach companies, one of the things I school them is customer experience does not have to be a loss center. Or, you know, a loss leader, it could be a profit center. Everyone always talks about how Ritz-Carlton, their tagline is ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. And every employee at Ritz-Carlton, from the janitor up to the GM, has the ability to spend up to $2,500 on their own decision. They don't need to ask anyone. They can just do it to fix any problem. The amount of time they spend anywhere near that much money is minuscule, right? Because when you go to a Ritz-Carlton, the people who are hired at the Ritz-Carlton are hired for empathy. They're not, you can teach anyone how to make hospital corners on a bed. You can't teach empathy. So you have to hire for empathy. And I will never forget being in the Ritz-Carlton Dubai back in 2013, coming back from a day of meetings. I was exhausted. And I get there and I get to bed. I'm about to brush my teeth to go to sleep. And I noticed that my toothpaste, which was empty, and I was like, you know, on those travel toothpaste, I was squeezing out like with a hammer, like that last pot. was full and it was brand new. Dear Mr. Shankman, we noticed your toothpaste was almost expired. We took the liberty of replacing it. We went to the store and got you the same brand. Hope that's okay. Sincerely, your room service people.
Talk about surprise and delight.
And what did it cost? Like $3.50? You know? And it's nothing more than that. That 99.9% of surprise and delight does not cost a fortune and does not require massive logistics, right? It requires listening and it requires empathy. You know, the Morton's story, I jokingly tweeted from a plane, hey, Morton's, why don't you meet me in Newark Airport when I land with a porterhouse? And they did. That's not a customer service story. That's a very, very fun story. But here's the thing. It wound up all over the media. It was everywhere. Morton's revenue went like up into double digits that year. But here's the thing. If they do that for me, but you go to Morton's, you hear about that, like, wow, that's really cool. I'm going to go to Morton's. I think that I want to experience that. And you go and they screw up your reservation and your drink is cold. That's even worse than had you not known about what they did for me. So what happens at Morton's? When I call Morton's to make a reservation, or anyone calls Morton's to make a reservation, hey, okay, sounds great. We'll see you Friday at 8 o'clock. By the way, are you celebrating anything? Oh yeah, it's my girlfriend's birthday. Oh, fun. What's your name? Her name's Gabriella. Okay, great. We'll see you, Gabriella, on Friday at 8 o'clock. Show up at 8 o'clock. We get seated almost, you know, immediately. And instead of the regular menus, it's a menu that on the top says, happy birthday, Gabriella. Well, what happens next? Gabriella Instagrams the shit out of that photo, right? Takes 45 minutes before I can even get a drink because she's all in that. But who are Gabriella's friends? Other women. Just like Gabrielle. Now all of their boyfriends are, oh, how come my boyfriend doesn't take me to Morton's first day? That's what it, what did that cost them? It cost them nothing, but they will keep coming back. That is how you do it. It doesn't have to cost a fortune. So I just had this conversation with someone who asked me to mentor them or to give them some advice about their graduating college. I said, just do the most basic research on me. Find me one thing that isn't on page 1 of Google about me. Find it. Maybe it's on page 3 or 4 and bring it up. Anything. Doesn't matter what. I used to have cats. You'll see photos that find that. Anything that tells me you did your homework, because that separates you from the countless resumes I get on a regular basis. Hello, I'd love to work for Shankman, because that's how my company is listed, right?
You know, good old Shankman. You should also tell them
exactly. Your mark, it's obviously. Like Vandalay Industries, right? Import and export. Just understand the basics.
All right, switching gears for a second. What's your favorite social media platform today?
Oh man, well, it's certainly not Twitter. Which is such a bummer. Twitter used to be my all-time favorite. I haven't deleted my account yet, but I don't tweet anymore. My pinned post is now, here's how to find me and everywhere else.
Why did you leave and when did you leave?
Well, I first left when Elon, back in April, when he said he was going to take it over. And then when he wussed out, I came back. And then when he bought it under duress, I was like, I can't be here anymore. You know, within 20 minutes of creating it, he tweets a Nazi meme and a conspiracy theory. I'm like, yeah, no, not good. And I mean, you know, we all knew this was going to happen. We knew it was going to be a massive tire fire from the second he wanted to acquire it. What do I love being on? So you're going to find this funny. I don't know if you'd call it a social network, but out of all the networks out there, this one actually improves my life. It's Peloton. And why would you call Peloton a social network? Well, I have a gang of people. So I have about 5 or 6 hashtags that I use on Peloton. Everything from ADHD cyclists to skydiver to Peloton ADHD dads. Right. All these different Peloton single dads, rather. And I have a group of people, whether on Facebook or LinkedIn, that have found me through this hashtag. And I can put a post on Facebook or just onto my email group, whatever. Hey, guys, need some accountability. Want to do a 2-hour ride tomorrow at 4 a.m. Who wants to meet me there? And without question, at least one person will. And that gets me out of bed, gets me onto the bike. And that exercise is what I do instead of taking medication from ADHD. And I know, I mean, I remember, I'll never forget, my daughter was 4 years old, it was like 5 years ago, and I didn't work out one morning, and she said, Daddy, did you get on your bike this morning? I'm like, no, honey, I slept. And she said, you're not as happy. I'm like, wow, you're 4. And so I don't miss a day. And so to be able to have the accountability that someone in London, where it's like, you know, 2 p.m., or someone in Japan, where it's like 4 p.m., or whatever, is going to meet me on the bike, gets me there every single morning. And the health benefits, both mental and physical, are like nothing else. So yeah, strange enough, I'd say Peloton, you know, Strava, any of the exercise apps and sites.
Amazing. All right. What's next on your bucket list?
On my bucket list? Well, I have a weird bucket list in the respect that like I've done a lot of my stuff. Like my profile photo on all my apps is me skydiving over the pyramids of Giza. So what's next? I'm using some of this downtime, strangely enough, to apply for acting gigs. I went to high school of performing arts. I graduated with people like Marlon Wayans, Omar Epps, Jennifer Aniston all my year. Adrian Brody was a year after me. which is really a badge of honor until Nicki Minaj announced that she graduated from there and screwed up for the rest of us. But anyway, so I haven't acted in probably like since 1990, except, I mean, if you call going on CNN all the time acting, I don't know. But so having this downtime, I've actually subscribed to some casting websites and some casting companies, and I have a deck, a reel, and I'm going out on auditions. And it's wild because it's like everyone else is there and you know that this is desperately what they want to do for the rest of their lives. And I give them so much credit for that. I'm just there just like, yeah, I need to kill a few hours where I have to pick up my daughter at school. You know, I don't fit in, but you know, it's just the excitement of going in and reading a monologue or talking to people, or who the hell knows? I mean, if I wind up being cast for a commercial or whatever, that'd be hysterical. But again, until the speaking kicks back in, and it will, because I booked all these speeches, but again, they're March, April, May. So I have a few months. So until that happens, I'm trying that.
I love that for you.
It's awesome. It's so much fun. I've gotten into boxing. I never used to box. I used to just lift weights and cycle. Now I'm boxing. I actually have my first match. I'm going to get my ass kicked from here to next week in December. So it's like, you know, life begins at 50, I suppose. I turned 50 in August. Now I'm doing all this weird shit, but it's a lot of fun. And I think that if I could teach my daughter one thing about it from all this, it's that just do whatever makes you happy. You'll figure out eventually what you're supposed to do. You know, I guess I'm supposed to be doing what I'm doing, but you know, don't worry about how to figure it out. Just do everything you possibly can whenever you have the time to do it, and what you're supposed to do will come.
I agree. Last question.
Yeah.
How do you ultimately want to leave your mark today?
Today, I'd like two things. I'd like for anyone who feels like they might be a little neurodivergent, maybe either they've been tested and been diagnosed with something or they haven't, but they feel like it, to understand that you're not broken, you're gifted. And if you allow yourself to work through that and to understand why it can be a benefit, there's nothing you can't do. If you're listening and you have a child who was recently diagnosed with ADD, ADHD, they're not broken. They're going to change the goddamn world. They have to understand they have a faster brain than their friends and they need to adjust accordingly. But once they do that, there's nothing they can't do. And then secondly, I know you have a lot of like students and just out of college kids who love your podcast. I've done my homework on you. I would just suggest that they, again, try everything they possibly can. There's no rule that says you have to be locked into one thing for the rest of your life or even the rest of this week. And the worst that can happen is what I've done is I've tried and I've failed. I've failed more times than I can count, but I love failing because every time I fail, I go, okay, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. Let's try it another way. I'll never hire anyone who hasn't failed. Fail a lot. Like don't look at failure as a downside. Fail as much as you possibly can. It's the greatest way to succeed.
Oh, Peter, that was wonderful. I love you. I love seeing you. I'm always rooting for you. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Oh, anytime. I love your show. I listen to 3 podcasts. I listen to you. I listen to the Ask a Jew podcast, which is awesome. It's a podcast run by 2 Orthodox Jews who just, you'd never know they're Orthodox Jews until they start talking about Orthodox Judaism.
Oh, and then, check that out.
And then, of course, mine, I listen to Faster Than Normal, which is all about ADHD. But yeah, I love you. I've been listening to you since day one.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this. If change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.